Case number 12-5393, Federal Trade Commission Appellant versus Boehringer Ingelheim Pharmaceuticals, Inc.
Excuse me. The court wishes to thank counsel for accepting the appointment as amicus. Most helpful to the court. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Hedges for the appellant, Mr. Rosenberg for the appellee.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court, my name is Mark Hegedus for the FTC. I'd like to reserve 5 minutes of my time for rebuttal. The district court here broadly and categorically held that disclosure of any aspect of Boehringer's withheld financial analyses would necessarily reveal its general counsel's thought processes because she asked for the documents. As a result, the FTC has none of Boehringer's contemporaneous financial analyses of the agreements under investigation. This unprecedented ruling would jeopardize the FTC's ability to investigate reverse payment agreements, which are frequently entered into at the same time as patent litigation settlements. This court should reverse the district court for three principal reasons. First, the withheld documents included generic entry forecasts, analyses of the financial impact of settlement options, and the economics of a co-promotion agreement. For the documents to qualify as opinion work product, the district court needed to determine that disclosure of the numbers in the PowerPoint presentations and the spreadsheets would provide insights into Mara Persky's legal opinions beyond what we already know, which is that she was concerned about antitrust liability. But the court did not find that she had sharply focused or weeded the numbers such that disclosure would reveal protected legal opinions. Second,
what does that mean? I mean, I know that's the language of the sealed case, the sharply focused and weeded the material. What does that mean?
An example of what that means can be found in one of the cases discussed in the parties' briefs. That is the case from the Fourth Circuit, involving an attorney's choice amongst several different kinds of formulas for calculating emissions from power plants. And the attorney had the opportunity there to, say, choose, I think, amongst 8 different options, formulas. And the attorney exercised her discretion and chose one of those. And the court concluded that in that choice,
But in the case in which that language was used, do you remember the facts of that case, the In Re Sealed case?
Oh, the In Re Sealed case, right.
That's where the language of sharply focused and weeded the materials comes from.
Right.
Remind me of the facts of that case.
So in that case, it involved attorney notes, and the question was the attorney note-taking...
Attorney notes of his client, right? This was Vince Foster, right?
Right, right.
And in that case, we held that they weren't opinion work product.
That is correct.
An attorney sitting down with his client talking about matters, and we said that there were portions of that weren't sharply focused and weeded. That's our precedent, we'll follow it, but I'm trying to get some help with how you do that, because I would have thought that when an attorney sits down with a client and takes notes about what the client says, that's about as close to the center of opinion work product as you could get, but that's not the case.
That's right, Your Honor. The case law draws this distinction between sort of just recitation of what, say, a witness said, and then some evidence of there being some more selection. Now, this case actually doesn't present quite as hard of situation in that the statements that we're talking about here are not even Ms. Persky's. These are all factual statements, factual documents that were created by Beringer business people. There were already a step removed.
But if they show what Ms. Persky was thinking, right, then they get to be opinion work product?
Well, first of all, they do need to show whether there was evidence of Ms. Persky's legal thinking. In addition, a part of that is also that they have to deal with Ms. Persky's legal opinions. And the record here, the context in which these documents were requested, suggests that the specific requests weren't concerned with legal opinions. She was asked during an under oath investigatory hearing whether or not she had provided legal assumptions to the business people when she asked for the documents. And she said, no, she had not. She was asked, why did you ask for these documents? She said, well, it was for business purposes. So even if Ms. Persky's thoughts somehow could come through these these numbers, the thoughts themselves don't seem to have dealt with legal opinion.
But can't, even, I guess, in a simple example of note-taking by an attorney of a client's interview, you could have a situation where, the attorney speaks with the client for, hours and only writes down aspects of the interview that pertain to one kind of factual scenario. Isn't the theory that's protected work product because it shows that the attorney was clearly concerned about that particular factual aspect of the case, which then, I guess, perhaps it gives some insight into the attorney's mental impressions? So I guess what I'm saying is, or what I'm asking you is, that it's not really work product necessarily because it discloses legal opinions. It's whatever the mental impressions are, whether they're legal or not. They could be factual mental impressions, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, so the distinction of whether it's opinion work product doesn't hinge on whether it's kind of a factual impression or a legal impression. Right.
There has to be what is given the highly protected status of opinion work product is legal opinion. The fact that there may be some of the attorney's thoughts on factual matters does not elevate that work product to this highly protected class of opinion work product. And then that's actually one of the errors of the district court, is that the district court collapsed the distinction between factual work product and opinion work product.
So if a lawyer interviews his client and writes down, I think that the most important facts that I gleaned from this interview are, that A happened, B happened, and C happened, that wouldn't be opinion work product because it's only discussing facts?
Given the precise example that you gave, Your Honor, that would represent fact work product, but there's nothing apparent in the context there that is revealing anything about the attorney's legal opinions.
I thought it was broader than that. I thought it was mental impressions of an attorney in anticipation of litigation, the mental process of an attorney are opinion work product. But you're saying that's not the case. You're saying only if they write down, and our theory of negligence will be XYZ.
I'm not saying that, Your Honor. It's the fact that with respect to factual information, the court requires that there be something that is revealing of the attorney's mental...
But in Judge Wilkins' hypothetical, there is. These are the facts that are important to the attorney.
In that situation, if it's clear from the context that the attorney wrote this down because those facts are important to the attorney, then yes. That could qualify as mental processes in a protected opinion work product. But it's important that we...
The mere fact of writing them down is going to suggest they're important, isn't it? I mean,
I guess it depends upon what was the approach that the attorney was taking to the particular interview.
Let's talk about the context of this case so I can understand what it is that the FTC thinks it's entitled to. All right? In other words, the attorney who's in charge of figuring out or making recommendations to the board about how to address these legal questions says, I need the following information about this company, and says, I want it over this period of 5 years. And so the financial people give her that. Now, as I understand it, that's what you want. Is that correct, in part?
We don't want the precise request of Ms. Persky, but
you want the 5 years.
We want the documents that were produced by the business people. And an example, well, I'm at a disadvantage here because I haven't seen the documents. But what I do have is a document that we attached to our exhibit in the activist complaint, which we cited.
Right, but I know we're not into the sealed documents here, but I'm just looking at what is not sealed in terms of the objections you raised and what you were seeking.
Yes, Your Honor, and I'd like to note, if I may answer the question, I want to reserve the 5 minutes of rebuttal. What we are seeking is just numbers, financial analyses, and the question is, do those numbers disclose attorney mental processes other than what we already know, which was that Ms. Persky was concerned about antitrust liability? And I point to the exhibit that we attached in our activist complaint as an example. I have to point to that because that's all I have at my disposal. And if you look at that, for example, if you were to look at the Supreme Court pagination, the Supreme Court Joint Appendix pagination, page 111, that shows a calculation of the financial impact of a co-promotion agreement. So the question is, would disclosure of those numbers, of those kinds of analyses, result in a disclosure of an attorney's mental impressions? And looking at that document, the answer has to be no. Another example would be a case that was attached by Beringer to its brief, the Fair Isaac Corporation case from the District of Minnesota. There, an attorney asked business people to prepare a financial analysis based upon some legal analyses. And the district court there refused to treat the document as opinion work product, even though it was based upon legal analyses.
That was a district court?
That was, Your Honor.
Where? In which circuit?
District of Minnesota, Eighth Circuit.
What's your response to, I guess the district court opinion doesn't say this explicitly, but Beringer says it explicitly in their brief, that basically you got lots of financial data and analyses, and so there really isn't harm here anyway, because they produce, you know, tens and tens of thousands of pages of financial data.
Your Honor, I have a twofold response to that. The first is, the standard is not whether or not our investigation is harmed. The question is whether or not we can get the same information elsewhere without undue hardship. Secondly, we can't get that information because what we're talking about here are analyses that were contemporaneous with the time that Beringer entered into the agreement. Yes, Beringer has produced other documents involving other co-promotion agreements, other time frames, but they haven't produced any of the documents pertaining with the time frame when these agreements were entered into and when the business people were analyzing them. And both the Supreme Court and courts of appeals have recognized the high relevance of these kinds of contemporaneous analyses to the antitrust questions, and particularly in this case, the Supreme Court's determination in activists that the central focus is, why did the parties prefer a reverse payment settlement as opposed to some other kind of settlement? That information is in the documents that Beringer has withheld, and we cannot reverse engineer it from other documents that Beringer has produced.
So if you were writing the opinion to give guidance here, that's what my question was getting at. You say the district court said, well, I've looked at these documents and they're just numbers. And your response is, that's exactly what we want. And Berenger says, no, 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 no. That's all in connection with the attorney's pulling together her thoughts, her approach, et cetera.
So, Your Honor, we would require district court and parties to demonstrate that the how the numbers reflect the attorney's mental processes, the legal opinion.
Well, the district court had testimony before it from what I'll call the financial people. So it could rely on that, correct?
It relied upon that, but we also have the testimony from Ms. Persky and herself saying that she did not give legal assumptions to those business people, that the reason why she asked for those documents was in order to determine the business parameters for the settlement. That does not suggest that her request and even revealing the documents that resulted from the request would disclose legal opinion. So in terms of giving guidance to the courts in the future, there should be a requirement that there's a linkage between the information disclosed in the document or the risk of disclosure if the document is released and some kind of request for or support for offering legal advice. One more example to try to make it more concrete here. Suppose that Ms. Persky had asked the business people to she was presented with the opportunity that there was a range of cost that could be assumed regarding the co-promotion services that Berenger was purchasing from Barr. And Ms. Persky told the business people, assume the higher number because I want it to appear as though we are actually getting value for what we're paying Barr. If Ms. Persky had said that that assumption could be determined from releasing the number, releasing the final analysis, then that might be able to be treated as opinion work product. But there's nothing in this record to suggest that that happened here. Now, it's possible that in these in-camera affidavits that we've not seen, that there is something like that, although based upon how the district court described those affidavits, it doesn't appear that that exists. At a minimum, it would be helpful that if the court were to uphold the district court decision, that it provide guidance regarding what is the appropriate standard for discerning or differentiating between fact and opinion work product, and simply noting that on the record of this case, those standards were satisfied. Your Honor, my time
All
is
right.
up.
Yes, we'll give you your rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor.
May it please the court, Lawrence Rosenberg for Appley Berenger Engelheim. I'd like to start with the last statement that Mr. Hegedus made. He states that if, in fact, the in-camera affidavits show that the financial analyses were prepared with counsel-specific inputs and the divulgement of those documents would show what the mental impressions of counsel were, then it would be opinion work product. And the court has the affidavits. That is exactly what they show.
I don't believe that's the case at all.
Yeah.
The affidavits are some pretty vague boilerplate language that, you know, I've seen, you know, this is my first rodeo as far as a privilege review. I was in private practice for a number of years, and I thought that they were pretty unhelpful. They didn't give any detail as far as what specific numbers were asked for, or anything. It just, if it seems to me that if these affidavits are sufficient, then parties can funnel requests through their lawyers as a conduit, and it's always going to be opinion work product.
I don't think that's correct, Judge Wilkins, and let me explain why. So in this case, to begin with, Magistrate Judge Facciola carefully looked at almost 100 documents, as well as the affidavits. And the standard of review in this case is extremely deferential. So it's clear error for the opinion work product determination, and as this court held in Office of Thrift Supervision, even more deferential than clear error for a substantial need analysis under fact work product. And what he did was he carefully looked at all these documents in conjunction with the affidavits, and what he determined was that the financial analyses, which is what the FTC is primarily complaining about, were all directed by Ms. Persky or outside counsel. Some were directed by outside counsel, that they used specific inputs, time frames, factors to examine, assumptions about generic entry, things like that, specific assumptions that were set out by the general counsel in order to assist evaluating various possible settlement terms. And in those circumstances, disclosure of those documents would most certainly reveal the mental impressions and thought processes of the general counsel, particularly, Your Honor, as I think you alluded to in one of your questions, when you compare it to the ordinary course materials that were produced. There were 270,000 pages of ordinary course materials, including thousands and thousands of pages of financial analyses.
The key pages, says the FTC.
Well, the only thing that wasn't produced were financial analyses of the co-promote agreement itself, because there was no ordinary course analysis of the co-promote agreement, because it came up only in the context of litigation. That's what the evidence before the district court showed. And the point is that disclosing whatever Ms. Persky directed about analyzing the co-promote, when you compare it to the ordinary course materials that include the financial projections generally by the company, that include, the FTC has all of the terms of the settlement themselves, the FTC has a fleet of economists that have already analyzed the terms. If you compare what Ms. Persky directed against what they already have, what comes out in the wash is the specific mental impressions and thought processes of counsel.
But after the Supreme Court opinion in Activists, I guess it is.
Yeah.
I mean, it's pretty obvious what counsel wants, and that is, you know, is this co-promotion agreement going to be, you know, what is the value here, and is that value reasonable? I mean, this isn't some big mystery as to what the counsel's mental impressions are. Run some numbers and tell me what the value is. Why is that opinion work product?
Because the kinds of numbers that are being run and the specific time frames and inputs that are being considered show the mental impressions. And
there's nothing in detail, counsel, that I saw in these affidavits that spells that out, other than just saying, you know, we provided guidance in that.
Well, I think
there's nothing in detail that says for this document we told them to run this, and this was what I told them, as opposed to what some business person did, or that these were not non-standard analyses.
But I think, Your Honor, again, you have to look at them in conjunction with the documents themselves, and in many of the documents that's pretty clearly spelled out. There are cover memoranda from counsel that say what the inputs are. There are cover memoranda, including from outside counsel, that talk about the inputs into the financial analyses. My point is that if you compare the privileged material with the ordinary course material, it's kind of like looking at a film, and the director has the original film. Then you bring a lawyer in, and the lawyer changes five frames and says, I want different lines, different actors, and different color background. When you look at them side by side, you can figure out exactly what the lawyer did to the film.
And all we're saying is that's not what the affidavits say happened here. And that's what I thought Seal Case was trying to get at. It's not enough to sort of ask. A, it's not enough that the attorney asked. That's number one. Two, it's not enough that you just ask for 5 years financials on a company.
Right, but
all right, the question is, as I think Judge Wilkins' hypothetical was, or somebody's hypothetical, or a counsel's point, that if counsel had said, these are the assumptions you are to follow and pick the highest number or something like that, that's a different situation. But isn't that the kind of detail you need, according to the suggestion in Sealed Case?
I don't think so. I think what Sealed Case was dealing with was if you have a total factual summary that doesn't disclose the mental impressions of counsel. In other words, my client told me the following 20 facts, and there's
right.
no
in the
selection.
The last 5 years, here are the profit and loss on this company.
I think even the point of looking at the last 5 years versus the last 6 years or the last 3 years divulges some of what counsel is thinking about. But I think that most of the documents are much more specific than that. And I think when you look at the documents in conjunction with the affidavits, that's explained, that it's much more specific. But I think even that divulges the mental impressions of counsel. It's different, for example, if counsel just says, hand me your ordinary course materials. In that circumstance, if you just say, give me the following ordinary course materials, that's not opinion work product. And in fact, there are several examples.
And are you drawing a distinction between a company that, say, publishes a quarterly report?
Right.
That would be ordinary course. But if counsel says, I want two quarters together, that's not in the ordinary course, and that comes...
If counsel just says, take two pieces of paper out of the ordinary course materials and give them to me...
All right, I want
maybe
April through October.
Right, but...
I mean, so that doesn't fall neatly.
Right. If you say specifically that input, I think it may well be opinion work product because you're divulging the mental impression of counsel. The other point I want to make about this, and this was a point that we made before the district court, and I think the district court found persuasive, is that releasing these materials that would show what counsel was thinking about, even if arguably not as strongly as some other things, would provide a roadmap to parties that wanted to sue a company like Boehringer and settle with them, because it would show exactly what things the general counsel's worried about in the context of a settlement. And that's something that the work product privilege is meant to protect against, and that is a real risk in this circumstance.
I didn't see that anywhere in the district court's opinion.
It was certainly discussed at length in the hearing before the district court, which is in the record. And I think there was some back and forth with Judge Facciola about that it's all in the joint appendix.
I mean, what I did see in the district court opinion, I mean, there were some aspects of it that I thought were overly broad, in that there was one statement at page 109 of the FRD site where the district court says information used to assess settlement options clearly falls within the ambit of the work product doctrine, seeming to suggest that any information that was used to assess is work product. That can't be the rule, right?
Well, I don't think that's the rule that the district court employed. What I think the district court was saying is, if you're talking about specific analyses of settlement terms and settlement options, that's work product, and that's exactly what was going on here. Judge Wilkins, if I could just mention the context here.
What he said was information used.
Yeah, but
to assess settlement options.
Right, but again,
so any information used to assess settlement options is opinion work product?
No, but I think information that is specifically generated and ordered by the general counsel, with parameters and inputs and things like you have here, is opinion work product because it divulges the mental impressions of counsel. And I think it's important to understand the context here is you had two different patent cases with different patents with different drugs. You had regulatory oversight by the FDA, by the FTC that was getting all of these agreements. You had dozens and dozens of lawsuits filed in these Hatch-Waxman situations. And you had a very tight time frame. And in that context, the general counsel, in conjunction with outside counsel, is saying, what are the things we need to look at to assess whether there's going to be legal liability or legal problems of a variety of sorts down the road? And when the counsel is saying, I need to look at this, this, and this, I need these 2 years or these two quarters to look at this information versus this information, things of that nature, which I think the documents reveal are the case.
So the counsel in doing that says, I need to see kind of what our lost profits will be if this generic comes on the market in X year, and let's look at that for every year and gather that information. That information, that request, and that information that was gathered as a result of that is necessarily opinion work product?
I think it is in the context here, because again, if you compare that to the ordinary course materials that look at overall generic penetration, overall lost profits if there's a generic for a multi-year period, then you see, well, the general counsel is only concerned about this 6 months or this year, and that divulges what the general counsel's thinking. So I think in the context here, yes. I mean, there may be other contexts where it's not the case, but I think where you compare it to ordinary course materials and you can divulge the mental impressions, then it's opinion work product. The other point I'd like to make, Judge Wilkins, is even if Magistrate Judge Facciola was crazy on the opinion work product stuff, surely this stuff is at least fact work product, because it was clearly embodied in advice that counsel was giving. And in that circumstance, he independently found that the FTC hadn't shown a substantial need for it. And again, under the Office of Thrift Supervision case, that determination is reviewed for even more deference than clearly erroneous. And the point is that the FTC does have information from which it can determine any anti-competitive effects. In fact,
what about our Exxon decision, in-bank decision, as to the limited role of the court where it's dealing with an investigatory subpoena?
Yes, but I think the point of that case was to say if there's a limited role in determining relevance, mm-hmm. and we're not really contesting that maybe some of this stuff is relevant, mm-hmm. our point is that once you get beyond relevance, the substantial need determination is for the court to make, and that is an extremely deferential standard of review.
Well, not for the court to say this wouldn't do the FTC any good in its investigation. I thought that was the point of Exxon in a nutshell.
Fair enough. But the point is that's really not what the court was doing here. What the court was saying was there is plenty of ordinary course material that the FTC can use to determine anti-competitive effects from what's in the record. And the court, again, looked at this stuff in camera, spent months analyzing it, and that determination is accorded very great deference. And the other point that I want to respond to is this notion that activists has somehow changed the rules.
But the district court says, and this is, I think it's page 110, the district court says, although I am sympathetic to the FTC's argument that these financial analyses, he's talking about the co-promotion agreement, are the only documents that could demonstrate whether or not BIPI was using the co-promotion agreement to pay Barr not to compete, I am afraid that they cast no light on whether that intent existed.
Right.
So it seems like his finding was that there was no other source, but he looked at the documents and he concluded from looking at them that even though there was no other source, these documents aren't really going to prove what the FTC says that they're going to prove or it believes that they can prove. Isn't that what he's saying there?
I don't think so, Judge Wilkins. What he's saying is on the specific question of intent, he's saying, I've looked at these documents and they don't show any evidence of intent. The question of whether intent is even relevant in a case like this is split in the courts. The point is that to show anti-competitive effects, which is what the cases say the FTC does need to prove under activists and other cases, they have the ordinary course material sufficient to do that.
I think what I'm trying to get at is that Exxon was trying to say that an investigatory subpoena, mm-hmm. if it's relevant, if it's within, if the investigation is within the agency's authority, where this evidence takes the agency is not for the court to try to evaluate at this point.
Right. I think there were two different things that were going on here, right? One is specifically on the question of intent, the Edelman decision in the Second Circuit, which this court has cited many, many times and relied on, says that if you're talking about intent, and I look at these documents in camera and there's no evidence of intent, that means that the documents don't rise to substantial need.
No, but what I'm getting at is that these documents may not prove intent,
mm-hmm.
but they may lead to conclusions, which lead to other things, which lead to at least what the agency concludes may be sufficient for it to prove evidence of intent. That's why I thought this court was being very careful to describe the limits of what the district court's role is. And here, at that stage, as opposed to after a complaint is filed, where this evidence takes the FTC is simply not a relevant consideration.
But I think the distinction, Judge Rogers, yeah, is between the relevance determination and the substantial need determination. I think they're different inquiries.
But I thought what Judge Wilkins' question was getting at, the judge has said these are the only documents.
Right. What he's saying is the FTC argues, again, there are two different things. Anti-competitive effects, which is what the law says they need to prove. They've already, in their brief in this case, said what they think this thing is worth. They have whatever evidence they need. If this ever went to a trial, it would be a battle of experts who's right about it. The second issue is intent, because the FTC argued separately below, we need this for intent. And what Magistrate Judge Facciola is saying is maybe this is the only evidence of intent, but I've looked at the documents and they don't say anything about intent. And so for my substantial need inquiry, I'm not going to say they have a substantial need for these documents because they themselves don't show anything about intent. I don't think he was trying to say that doesn't also mean that they don't get them because they don't have a substantial need for them, because to show any competitive effects, which is what they need to show, they have plenty of other evidence to do it. I think that this was somewhat shorthand responding directly to their intent argument that they made below, which is different from the broader substantial need argument that they need them for what the cases say they need, which is any competitive effects, which they more than fully have. Just one or two quick points, if I may. I see my time is up. One is, I think the FTC has taken a much broader position in this case than the documents warrant. We've never taken the position that just because a lawyer looks at it, it means it's work product. That's not what these documents show. That's not what the magistrate judge held. Secondly, the FTC has repeatedly relied on this one out-of-context statement by Ms. Persky that in a particular document she was giving business advice, but I do think the affidavits, if nothing else, reflect that for the vast majority of documents she was giving legal advice or looking at them for legal purposes. Third, the FTC mentions the complaint and the document attached to the activist complaint. That was not a lawyer-generated document in any way. It's generated by somebody in strategic and business analysis of Solvay. It's very different. That was an ordinary course document, not a work product document of the type that's at issue here. So in conclusion, I think the standard of review is extremely deferential. And so unless the court thinks that Magistrate Judge Facciola literally lost his mind on this, well, it's pretty deferential, and we think that where the magistrate judge spent a great deal of time carefully analyzing the documents along with the affidavits, the appropriate course is to affirm. Thank you.
All right. Counsel for appellant.
Your Honors, a few brief points. First of all, counsel for Beringer is wrong that the district court determined that we had not shown substantial need for factual work product. The district court actually ordered Beringer to release emails with the fact work product disclosed if they could be segregated, if the fact work product could be segregated from the opinion work product. The district court found that we had met the substantial need standard for fact work product. Secondly, even if Beringer has not taken the position that as broad as they say we're claiming, Beringer's sister pharmaceutical companies are taking that position. That is how they're reading the district court's decision, and they're withholding documents saying attorneys requested this document, it's therefore opinion work product, we can't give it to you. And that's why
that's a mischaracterization of what the magistrate judge did. I mean, he was pretty careful to say that he was looking for documents that show specific input from the attorney. So that's.
But I'm just trying to give the court an understanding of how the district court's decision is being interpreted by the industry and how it's creating difficulties with respect to our investigations. On the co-promotion agreement, Beringer's counsel suggested that analysis was unique. In fact, we have testimony that Beringer regularly does financial analyses of co-promotion agreements. In the district court decision, the district court noted that Barenger conceded that it regularly enters into these kinds of analyses. What apparently made this unique was the fact that attorneys asked for it. But that isn't enough, as we've been discussing. And I point you back to the Fair Isaac Corporation case, where the attorneys asked for a business analysis that was based upon other legal analyses, and the court refused to afford opinion work product to it. Finally, I'd like to note on intent. Intent bears on competitive effects. We cite cases in our brief that intent evidence helps give investigators and courts information about what are the potential effects of an agreement. And that's why this contemporaneous intent evidence is important and highly relevant to our investigation.
What do you think we should make of the district court's statement about how he was sympathetic to the FTC's arguments about the co-promotion agreement, but that he was afraid they cast no light on whether that intendment existed?
We think, Your Honor, that in that situation, the district court stepped out of rule, the proper rule for the district court. The district court in subpoena enforcement role is to determine whether or not the information is reasonably relevant to our investigation. The district court's role is not to determine whether or not the document is probative of what we are investigating. The district court simply didn't have enough evidence before it to make that determination. We put before the district court 87 example documents. The district court does not have the benefit of everything else the FTC would look at. The district court does not have the benefit of even a complaint setting forth a legal theory. So the district court, that was not a legitimate basis to reject our need claim based upon whether or not it was probative. And when it comes to fact work product, in fact, the district court found that Barenger should release the fact work product, and so implicitly determined that we had met substantial need.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Take the case under advisement.